Welcome to the 270th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Thank you for listening. Well, what's going on in my life? Still training for the races that I hope take place in November and December. Hope the wildfires are getting a little bit better under control. It doesn't look good in some places. But again, heading out to California in December for the California International Marathon in Sacramento. Hopefully heading out to Austin area for a swim run in November. So we'll hope that goes well. Continuing my mobility exercises faithfully, and I think that's working. And we're incorporating more and more of that, not only into my practice, but into our office practice. And currently I'm doing this podcast standing up and incorporating some practices during the day, some squats, intermittently trying not to sit too much, trying to do a little sit on the ground to keep those hips as mobile as I possibly can. Our wellness challenge this month is a lunge challenge that Addie Delaney Minerich has set up for our members. So we try to keep everybody moving and mobile because I think you have to remember that, you know, if your knees hurt, a lot of people say they can't run because their knees start to hurt them. It's not really their knees that are bothering them. It's the quadriceps that are very tight. Maybe the hip flexors are very tight. And pulling on that end detachment, those tendons attached down the knee, both from the quadriceps and the hamstrings. Same thing with feet. We have people in our running group, plant-based runners, the plant-based striders and bikers, talking about Achilles issue and feet issue. That typically is from, you know, ankle and calf tightness. So doing mobility work, a lot of times people just put their calf or their leg behind them and push down, and that's really just stretching the Achilles, where you really need to focus up high into the calf muscles to release those, to give yourself a little bit more room. Again, the squats help with ankle mobility, release of the calves, and mobility into the calves help with the feet and people that have Achilles issues or the people that have plantar fasciitis. Back issues, I've talked about this, you know, a lot on the podcast before. You know, the lumbar back is, you know, there can be a disc area, but there also can be tight hips, tight quadriceps that inhibit glute function, and your back takes the brunt of the work. So things that I'm working on and trying to incorporate into our practice as well, and it's going good. Gardening in Florida is pretty much at a halt. It's very, very hot and humid here. So hopefully we're starting to get a few nice days. The temperature will start to break and we'll be able to get the fall planting season going again. So we're kind of on a standstill for the most part. One of the things I'd like to start with, everything kind of falls together. Sometimes I don't know exactly what I'm going to talk about in this podcast or even nutrition class, but I run into things. I run into things into practice, in the hospital, daily living, in reading. But in the Journal of American Medical Association released a study recently looking at obesity and hypertension. And they put it, put that in the context in the times of COVID. So it's one of the first pieces that have actually identified risk factors as a risk for COVID, and in that we should actually address them, other than, yeah, if you have hypertension or you're obese, you have a higher risk of comorbid conditions with COVID. This we're actually starting to look at, you know, what's going on with the particularly American society. And they looked and did a review from the National Health and Nutritional Examination Survey that spans 1999 to 2018. Looking at the trends in obesity and the trends in controlled hypertension. So not just the diagnosis of hypertension, but do we get it under control? And of course, you know, obesity is a risk factor for every other lifestyle disease, you know, including diabetes, cardiovascular disease, fatty liver disease, and some cancers. And they looked at obesity not only in adults, but in children, looking at kids that are in the 99th percentile, from before teenage years and after teenage years, and they saw kids in the 7 to 11 age group, their increased risk of obesity, which is the 99th percentile in the child height and weight score, went from 15.8 to 19.3%. So that's huge. Adolescents, 16 to 20.9% of adolescents is in the obese category, severe obesity, which is greater than the 120th percentile for body mass index, increased up to 4.9% in whites, 13% in non-Hispanic blacks, and Hispanics 12.5%. Adults with a body mass index of greater than 30, which is considered obesity, increased in all the years, 99 to 2000, 217 to 218, going all the way from 27% up to 43% in males and 33% in females. Greater than 40, you know, went up to 6.9% in males and 9.7% in females. If you look at controlled hypertension, there was a period of time where we kind of had a diagnosis of hypertension and there was more control. But from 2013-14 to 2017-18, there was actually a decrease in controlled hypertension. And this was particularly evident when they looked at areas of the country, which we call the stroke belt, the Southeast United States, typically more rural areas, low socioeconomic status, all associated with that. And, you know, factors contributing, again, education, and then there's this thing called a food desert. You know, is there healthy food available? Are people living out of 7-Elevens and dollar stores? Is that where they're getting their nutrition? And certainly education is a huge role in food availability. And so the NIH came up in their infinite wisdom with, it's firmly committed, and this is a quote, NIH says it is firmly committed to supporting research to understand and ameliorate the cause and consequences of disease affecting minorities and low social economic people with regards to hypertension and obesity. And it's like, okay, so we know the cause, right? We know the cause is nutrition. And this transitions me into, I was shopping, actually I went to the local grocery store last Friday to get a quick lunch before we had nutrition class, and I'm standing there waiting on my vegan sushi. And I look across and there is a sale rack of SpaghettiOs. And there was probably, you know, probably almost as high as I was, SpaghettiOs, 10 cans for $10. And I couldn't help myself but to go over and take a picture of the can and the nutrition facts. And a serving size of SpaghettiOs is 290 calories with a whopping 1,070 grams of salt. Essentially no fiber. It says right on the can that it's made with genetically modified soy, corn, and wheat products. There's, you know, high fructose corn syrup. There's everything in there, you know, except nutrition. Some sort of, you know, fake cheeses with a little bit of real dairy. And, you know, it's a mess. But, you know, obviously a very unhealthy lunch for somebody that, again, you know, school's just starting down here. If they're going to put that in the lunch, would be awful. And certainly things like that not only contribute to obesity, but if you look at, you know, we want people to stay under 1500 milligrams of sodium for a day, and for lunch they're hitting 1070. And the reality of it is if they had fruits and vegetables the rest of the day, that would give them another 700-800 milligrams. So they're already over their salt intake. And you know, we see in the practice of cardiology people coming into the hospital on 3 and 4 different medications to control blood pressure and to control heart failure, and we put them on a 1500 milligram sodium diet, and you know, the water just falls off of them, the blood pressure sinks, and we can't back off of medications. So I mean, it's really, really the food really contributes to heart failure, hypertension, and obesity, and it actually gets worse as we age because we're less able to tolerate it. I don't believe this is a something that's going to be solved by the NIH. It's not going to be solved by government regulation. Let's face it, on TV, most ads are sponsored by food companies, you know, ball games sponsored by Pepsi, Coca-Cola. So everything's right there as far as, you know, the government subsidies to fast food places. It's not going to happen there. It's going to have to be a grassroots educational effort to help people understand. And I really don't believe that you know, just saying there's a food desert and what do we do because there's a food desert. I think, you know, again, we need to teach people the skills to be able to have, especially in the South. You know, there's no reason why people can't start to do gardening, have a little bed of tomatoes, learn educated ways of shopping and figuring out ways to better feed themselves. But it becomes something that, again, people have to be educated and they have to want to do it and it has to be important to them. And they have to be able to recognize that food is actually the problem. It's not some mystery disease that's grabbing us and we wait for, you know, a vaccine, so to speak, to come in to save the day, which is not going to save the day for any of us. Because, again, hypertension, obesity, increased risk for infectious disease processes, an inflammatory state. So unless we address those, it doesn't matter how many vaccines or how many medicines we have, people are still going to suffer. And it leads me to look at, or want to talk a little bit about coconut oil. That seems to be the boom. You know, people talk about coconut oil being the healthy oil because it is a medium chain triglyceride. And, you know, what is a fat and a triglyceride and a fatty acid, it all becomes very confusing and people say, you know, you need good fats and that's where it stops. And then people label what they think is good fat, anything that they happen to like is a good fat. You need good fats. But nobody really understands if you have this, you know, piece of fat, what does it break down into it, you know, into a fatty acid and then it breaks down into a triglyceride and how is it actually absorbed? And, you know, by organic chemistry definition, coconut oil was labeled as a predominantly medium chain triglyceride, and medium chain triglycerides are typically handled more by the lymphatic system and it takes a while before they actually hit the bloodstream, and a lot of the fatty acids, the medium chain fatty acids, can be used by the liver for energy and less stored, and so that's what people hang on to. But the reality of it is a medium chain triglyceride, the number of carbons is 12. And that in the upper limits to be classified is 12. And coconut oil is made predominantly of stearic acid, the fatty acid, and that is a 12 carbon fatty acid, which is actually handled more like a saturated fat. So a saturated fat is absorbed into the bloodstream and most of it is actually stored. So there's really little of coconut oil that actually acts like a medium chain triglyceride. It's more of a saturated fat. And of course, you know, then the other fats in coconut oil are saturated. It's in everything. People, you know, I got sent a recipe today that was a non-grain breakfast cereal. And it contained coconut flour, and it contained chia seeds, and it contained sunflower seeds, and all these, you know, and it's a very high fatty breakfast that most people can't really handle. And especially when you're looking at, you're gonna take something that could have been oatmeal and blueberries, and you're gonna make it coconut flour, so now you're really making it a saturated fat that's gonna lead to more inflammation. So beware of the coconut flours, coconut oils. It's really not doing anybody any good. When we look at essential fatty acids, then we're looking at omega-3 fatty acids, which go to anti-inflammatory compounds and anti-clotting, and omega-6s that go to more clotting compounds, more inflammatory compounds. They use the same enzyme. We need about 1% of our calories in essential fatty acids. We can't make essential fatty acids on our own, so you have to eat them. Well, omega-6s are everywhere. They're in meat products. They're in nuts. You know, they're in avocados. They're in all the processed oils. But your omega-3s are a little bit harder to come by. Hemp seeds, flax seeds, chia seeds, kale, some beans. You don't need a lot, but you need that ratio to be about 1 to 3, max 1 to 6. 1 being the omega-3s, 3 to 6 being the omega-6s. So it's not about getting more omega-3s and stuffing them into every place. It's more about limiting the omega-6s. So if you looked at that breakfast cereal that I got sent the recipe for, coconut, it's going to be, you know, saturated fat, some omega-6s, all the nuts and seeds are going to be omega-6s, there's some flax, a little bit of omega-3, so it's really going to be heavy on the omega-6 side. And then you got to look in what else you take in the rest of the day. So it can be very problematic. Most people know to stay away from trans fats or hydrogenated fats. They're man-made in order to make them more stable at room temperature. They've been associated with inflammation and cardiovascular disease, as are saturated fats. So we don't have any requirement for saturated fats. We're able to handle that on our own. We can make those, and we're going to get those in our foods every day, so we don't have to go looking for saturated fats. People ask me about arrhythmias in a plant-based diet, and can eating a plant-based diet reverse things like atrial fibrillation? There's not been really much in the way of studies looking at rhythms per se, because an arrhythmia is an electrical conduction abnormality that's really secondary to some structural abnormality in the heart and the electrical system, whether there's calcification or stretch. And there was actually a study published again past week in the American College of Cardiology that looked at the epicardial fat, meaning the fat that sits on top of the heart that actually penetrates down into the top chambers associated with atrial arrhythmias, and there was a strong association. So when people are overweight and obese, they tend to get more fat around the heart. When we're reading an echocardiogram, we refer to it as epicardial fat pad. So the heart is actually entrapped in fat, and this can cause conduction abnormalities. You know, whether someone slims down and their arrhythmias can get under control, or the damage is too late, no one has looked at, but certainly it is another reason not to become significantly overweight, and how being overweight affects the rhythms of the heart, along with, you know, lung disease and sleep apnea and difficulty breathing and hypertension. That all goes into promoting these atrial arrhythmias. That's basically stress on the conduction system of the heart because of stretch, and the heart becomes enlarged. The other thing that people come in and ask me about are bone density tests. You know, people say, I have a bone density test every year and it showed this or that. Well, finally, there has been a study in the Journal of American Medical Association that looked at bone density measurements at baseline and in 3 years, looking at the Women's Health Initiative. And they are not predictive at all at looking at fracture risk. So there's no reason to be radiated to look at bone density. There's nothing that we're gonna do, nothing that bone density test is gonna tell us that's gonna predict whether or not you're gonna break something. What is needed is an exercise program, especially in people around menopause and postmenopausal, that is weight bearing to maintain your muscle strength. And that ultimately leads me into what I really wanna talk to you about is a Netflix on barbecue in Texas that featured a lady called Tootsie Tominets. And I'd like to try to find her and get her on, but I don't think I can get her on the podcast. If I can, I certainly welcome her. What a wonderful insight that she actually has. But I want to talk to you about her and what I observed looking at this Netflix documentary on Texas barbecue. And you may think, you know, I'm going off my rocker here with a plant-based wellness podcast talking about Texas barbecue. You know, the first thing I did talk about a couple weeks ago, talking about dog care and feeding dogs raw, and now I'm talking about barbecue. And, you know, gee, is Dr. Delaney starting to shake in her boots about plant-based nutrition? Absolutely no. But I do learn a tremendous amount about people and observation and our views on things. This was a very positive documentary. Tootsie is, I believe they said she was 85. I saw some references online that she might actually be 87, but 85, we're gonna say, when this was filmed. And she is a pit master at Snow's Barbecue in Texas. And apparently Texas barbecue is a very big thing, and it's typically something on a Saturday morning that people go, and they go from one barbecue place to another eating barbecue. And this one was featured on Netflix mainly because of Tootsie. And, you know, it showed these giant slabs of meat, and they were seasoned with just handfuls of salt and pepper and cooked, and people were eating, you know, 16, 18 ounces with white bread and Coca-Cola or Dr. Pepper and, you know, maybe a little bit of creamy coleslaw, maybe some potatoes, but very little of that, mainly just big plates of meat people are eating. And they would come and they'd stand in line specifically for this Snow's barbecue because Tootsie's such an icon, and getting this big slabs of meat. And people from all races and ethnic backgrounds, but everybody had a pretty big BMI, you know, body mass index. So there weren't little people lining up to eat this big Texas barbecue. And neither was Tootsie. But Tootsie's 85 years old, and Tootsie's story goes that her husband was, when he came back from being in the service, started working in a butcher shop, and eventually she had three children, and eventually she started helping in the butcher shop, and on Saturdays they would barbecue the meat that was left over. And in 1996, her husband had a severe stroke that left him unable to walk or move around, and she took some time off, but eventually went back, and the people that bought the market started a barbecue up, and they wanted her to be, you know, the pit master for the barbecue because she really knew what was going on and had learned this great technique of open fire barbecue, of brisket and so forth. And so not only did she do that, so she'll wake up at 2 o'clock on, she'll be at the barbecue Snow's at 2 a.m. on a Saturday morning to get things ready, shoveling coals, shoveling ash, putting the meat on the flames, and working there all day long. You know, heavy, heavy labor, shoveling with a big shovel. The other thing that she does, she was raised on a farm. She still has the farm. She still tends to some cattle son helps out, but she does, you know, she trims branches on trees, she takes care of the property. She also works 30 hours a week as a custodian at a local school where she takes care of the, you know, the football stadium. She, you know, does all the inside custodial work. And, you know, so she's a big member of the community. She's a member of her church community. So everybody knows Tootsie, but she's very, very active. So she works, again, 30 hours during the week as a custodian, does her own, you know, takes care of her own property, takes care of herself, and works at the pit on Saturday. Her husband finally passed away in the mid-2000s. He had been a nursing home patient for all those years after having a stroke. She had a son that helped her a little bit at the barbecue, and he passed away at age 50 of a brain tumor. And Tootsie's not a small woman. She's, you know, she's a big woman. She handles the weight of all those things she does with fair ease. She walks with a little bit of a limp, but you know, I would say that if I had to guess Tootsie's BMI, she probably gets into the obese category, which was a BMI greater than 30. So the first thing you're going to tell me is, well, okay, so Tootsie is 85 years old, and there's a picture of her sitting down to eat, and she had a big piece of meat with white bread and a, you know, a soda. And so she eats what she wants. She's never smoked, but she doesn't take any medications. She is overweight, but again, her muscle mass is really, really good for an 85 year old, and able to, you know, for what she's able to do. So, you know, does it matter? You know, can some people, is it just her genes? Or does it really make a difference with what you eat? You know, obviously she's eating a low fiber diet. She doesn't have colon cancer. So, you know, how can I say that you should be plant-based? And obviously it you know, it must just be your genes. It doesn't affect you. So I wanted to go back and kind of look at this because it does make you wonder a little bit. And certainly there are people that have longevity genes that tend to be able to clear out DNA alterations as quickly as they come on. And so despite smoking and drinking and being overweight, there are people that live into their 90s. And it's a small percentage of people, but it certainly does happen. I would guess that if you looked at Snow's barbecue on a Saturday, that most of the people are on some medication. But I didn't know that, so I can't say. But what I can say is there are five family members. She had three children, a husband, and herself. And two out of the five have died at a fairly early age. That means there's a 40% early death rate in her family. So, you know, that's not, you know, so now we're looking at the things in with a little different perspective. So Tootsie has managed to dodge the bullet, but, you know, 40% of her family has not. I don't know the health of the other two children. They are alive, though. So it's not all rosy for, you know, the family. But what does she have on her side? And if I look at it, you know, I don't know many people at her age as active as she is. She doesn't appear to ever hardly sit down. She's up early in the morning, pushing a mop, pushing a broom, lifting, tugging, cutting tree branches. So doing heavy work, not just 30 minutes on a, you know, recumbent bicycle at, you know, 10 miles an hour, just jolly riding around. She is a, what you would call a very, very hard worker. If you look at her, you know that the years of hard work, you can see it on her. Not in an unhealthy sort of way. Certainly she's obese and you see the unhealthiness of that way and you wonder what it could have been, but nevertheless, she's tolerating. So I would have to say that when I look at her, I look at her as having a high metabolism. She has a high amount of muscle so that her mitochondria are preserved, that so she's able to metabolize the things that she's taking in pretty good. She has a good set of genes that are allowing her to handle the low fiber and the byproducts of you know, cooked meat at a long hot temperature much better than the average person. But I gotta say that I think it's her, you know, this constant activity that she's, you know, she's keeping up. She's, if you look at the pictures of her when they first did the barbecue back in the 60s versus now, that, you know, certainly she's packed on 30 or 40 extra pounds. But in some way, she's been able to stay ahead of the metabolic waste that she has generated over the years. So I'm going to give her, you know, high marks for activity and hard work. You know, the documentary showed, you know, she was really sweating when she was working. So it's high heart rate, high activity that she's actually clearing a lot of this metabolic toxicity from her. The other thing, you know, so I would say she's uncomfortably working most of the time, and she's always on her feet. You know, from sunup to sundown, she's always doing something. So she's moving more than she isn't. And if anything, again, that this is an advertisement for that sitting is a killer, that you should be moving and moving strong, not just as we would call dilly-dallying along. The other thing is she has a purpose. She took care of her husband. She went back to the barbecue. She is the matriarch, the pit master in charge. Very humble, but very much the boss lady. And that's her purpose in life there. And the purpose in life to take care of the kids at the school is a custodian. She greets them. She has this social interaction with the people at the barbecue, the social interaction in her church, social interaction in school where people know her, love her, hugs are abounding. And, you know, so, she, you know, a very strong connection to her community. Her outlook on everything is positive. There were times, you know, there was a segment where, you know, she was given an award and she showed up the day after her husband passed away and she, you know, she brushed away the tears and went up and took the award because that was what needed to be done because she was representing Snow's barbecue. And so I would say that, you know, she takes a moment, she has highs and lows like everybody else, but she's able to redirect her mood in a positive way and spin things on what she needs to do. And she, you know, she says she has, this is her purpose. And as long as God has a purpose for her, then she's going to continue to do it with all her might. So, you know, I come back to it, you know, you have the choice to take these situations and do exactly what you want to do. And this, that purpose that she has is, you know, not a self purpose, but a purpose that for others. And I think it goes along, you know, with the, it's so important that we have a village, a tribe, a herd, a community that we interact with. We try to do that here in a plant-based wellness community in Port Charlotte, our running groups, even in our online presence, to give people a sense of community that they belong and that they're part of a group, because 96% of people don't eat plant-based. And, you know, a lot of their kids shun what they do, is thinking that it's, you know, it's not a necessary thing. So I think that the community is extremely important. So, you know, when you're, if you're in the process of making the transition to plant-based nutrition, how do I put this all together? I think the majority of people that I run into, the metabolic waste has already gotten ahead of them. They have stents, they have high blood pressure, they have diabetes, they're on medications. They've had a stroke. They're trying to clear the metabolic waste. They're not ahead at all. If you have cancer, you know, you're not ahead. The DNA has broken. Things are out of hand. So we're trying to pull back on the reins of disease in the medical community. But what do you do with that? What do you do with that information? You know, you often hear something's going to get you. You could say, you know, I know so-and-so lived to be whatever, and they did what they want. We have Tootsie here now that's, you know, eating giant portions of meat, and she's still alive. Why should I have to change? And again, I think it's this metabolic excess that, you know, along with your genetics that get you in a certain situation. You still have the choice of what you want to do. You know, what's your purpose? What is most important to you? What are your needs, and what do you need? You know, what do you have left to do in this life? And I think that's what becomes very important, and that's what we need to drive home, both to our lower to places where there's a food desert, but specifically driving it home to the younger population, the teenagers and younger people that are already morbidly obese, already having lifestyle diseases. They're not going to make it to Tootsie's age. You have to remember that when Tootsie was in her 30s, she was still a thin, trim woman, and it blossomed over the next 50 years, I guess it would be, alongside her hard work. But people that are starting this now in their 30s and 40s, maybe teens, their metabolic waste is going to be so far ahead of them that it's going to be hard to turn back the clock. And I don't think many people can sustain the activity. Most of us have, you know, inside jobs. We have very little exposure to sunlight. We're not outside working. If we are, it's limited hours. It's not day in and day out. So I think you have to take that into account when you're looking at what you can possibly get away with. I kind of played around with doing the math. So if you ate a 16-ounce brisket every Saturday and you didn't eat anything else, maybe except kale the rest of the week, could you get away with it? You know, would you have the same longevity as if you ate a plant-based diet? I don't think so. I think that your body can't clear those toxins, especially if you're living a regular lifestyle. But I think you have to look at your own lifestyle and your own goals and ambitions and what you want to do. But, you know, from what I can see, people lined up at the barbecue. It's not a healthful type of environment for most people. You know, there's always going to be a few survivors, but to look at, you know, the minority and say that if she can do it, we can do it, I think that's probably not the way to go. We know that you can turn back that clock and clear out the metabolic waste, but it becomes much more difficult the more waste and the more disease that you already have. You know, we have to turn back the clock and clear things out. People do intermittent fasting, you know, to try to clear things out, you know, quicker, but it's the day in and day out what you're taking in. So we want to get the nutrients in and the bad stuff out. If I could give you a big takeaway from, you know, Tootsie and the coconut oil and the study on hypertension and obesity, you know, I would say, you know, keep moving and figure and find out ways to move more and to move more vigorously. To find ways that you enjoy your food just as much as those people that were making the brisket. It's a love of Tootsie's to make brisket. but there are lots of ways to make good food that can bring great joy to your family. You just have to look at it that way, and it's all on how you look at it. I love making food for my family, making sourdough bread for my family, making good desserts for my family on it intermittently. I love that we can do gardening and you know, have mangoes and different fruit trees and kale and collards and go get those and put those into dishes that we make. I love that we can do nutrition class here and prepare food that really wows people and that they want to go home and make. And I think that that's really important. And you know, through all this COVID, we're open back up here in nutrition class, and people are coming in, and people couldn't be more happy than to be back together with their plant-based nutrition people, sharing in the joy of cooking nutritious food. And so I think you can have it all. I don't think you have to roll the dice and hope you're one of the few people that have the genes that can eat what Tootsie ate. I think you have to accept that your genes may not be as good, and what can you do to achieve the goal that you want to in life? And I'm sticking with plant-based nutrition as the safest way around that. So I hope you found it enjoyable. You can go on over to Netflix. I think you put Netflix and barbecue and Tootsie, you'll pull up a lot of things and you can see that. If you have questions for me, you can email me at jamie@drdelaney.com. It's drdulaney. Always go over to our website at drdelaney.com and check out our website. We have our plant-based wellness cookbook that has recipes that our family loves and that are easy to prepare and that I think your family will love. You can get that on Amazon. And you know, I'm going to keep moving my body. I'm going to move even more and stand more and sit less and continue to eat a whole food plant-based diet. And I hope that you'll join me in doing that. Have a good weekend. Talk to you next week.